mansion with a tear in every room. All I want's the love you promised beneath the haloed moon. But you think I should be happy with your money and your name, and hide myself in sorrow while you play your cheating game.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and in a moment, the world's most celebrated hacker, Kevin Mitnick, that's what it is. He's quite a guy, and in a moment, we'll try and find out why he's so celebrated. Kevin Mitnick, directly ahead. Kevin Mitnick is a security consultant to corporations worldwide. He's co-founder of Defensive Thinking, a Los Angeles-based consulting firm, defensivethinking.com. He has testified before the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs on the need for legislation to ensure the security of the government's information systems. His articles have appeared in major news magazines and trade journals. He's appeared on Court TV. Yeah, I bet. Good Morning America, 60 Minutes, CNN's Burden of Proof, and Headline News. Kevin has been a keynote speaker as well at numerous industry events, and in fact has hosted his own weekly radio program on KFI 640 in Los Angeles, the 50,000-watt torch in L.A. Here is Kevin Mitnick. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Art. Great to be on your show again.
You're down in L.A. somewhere, right?
In Santa Monica.
Santa Monica, all right. Not everybody thinks you're celebrated. They used, on our website, we have the world's most celebrated hacker.
I didn't write that copy.
Oh, I know. I'm sure someone else did. Anyway, Roy from North Little Rock, Arkansas, he read that. He said, hey, Art, what gives this thief the right to be on your show? Hackers are the lowest form of criminal, along with capital offenders. If I had my way, he'd still be in prison, doing hard labor, and he'd never get out.
Okay. Got the ultra-conservative listener, huh?
Yes, well, celebrated. You would probably not have used that term. I mean, you don't get off an airplane with adoring crowds going, Kevin, 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 right?
No, but I do get recognized a lot, and it's by people that look to me in a favorable way. I was just in New York. I just actually flew in from New York yesterday, and I was actually walking in Manhattan, and this guy walked by me. And goes, "Oh, hey, Mitnick," I took a double take. I go, "Huh?" And I go, and he goes, "Yeah, I know all about you." Blah 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 blah. And it was like kind of strange, you know, being recognized right on the street, especially in Manhattan.
Well, so, there's a book now, right? The Art of Intrusion, Kevin Mitnick. Oh, it's a good-looking cover, too, all black and red and very shocky.
Yeah, the publisher did a good job at the design of the cover. I really like it.
Yeah, it's really nice. So that's your The Art of Deception. So this is your new
That's the second book. The first one was The Art of Deception.
Yeah, I was reading the back here, where it talks about the art. Actually, you talk a lot about the art of deception. We're going to talk about that tonight, right? The art of deception?
Sure, absolutely. The reason that I chose the titles The Art Of is really paying tribute to the book The Art of War, one of my favorites, by Sun Tzu.
Okay. All right. Listen, I promised a caller that I would ask you something. The caller said that when you were arrested, you made some statement kind of like, no matter what happens, have it be remembered that I'm a patriot. Did you say that when you were arrested?
I don't recall saying that. Maybe I did. That was, you know, this was over a decade ago. Mm-hmm. I remember at the time that the government had bandied about that I had hacked into computers at the CIA and sent very sensitive secret computers, which never did happen. So I was always afraid that they would try to argue this in the court of public opinion. Of course, they didn't do it, and I was never charged, nor arrested, nor convicted of it. But I was always afraid that they would have.
So you might have said something like that.
I might have.
Yeah.
I remember it was kind of interesting because when I was in North Carolina, I was initially arrested around Valentine's Day of 1995.
Yeah, we should be clear. The audience should be clear on what you did and how you got arrested. So, yeah, you've told it a million times, but a lot of people, you know, tonight will not have heard. So let's tell it.
Sure. Well, since I was a young kid, I was fascinated with CB radios and then went into amateur radio. Then I got into a hobby called phone freaking, which was kind of like hacking the phone system. It was like exploring the telephone network. Mm. You heard of things called blue boxes. I didn't actually directly work with blue boxes. My interest was learning about switching and stuff like this. And then when the phone company went computerized, because at the time I started this, it was electromechanical switching, when they went to ESS, that's when I, you know, became interested in computers, and I took a class in high school, and one of the first programs that you learn to write, or one of the first assignments, was finding the first, you know, 100 Fibonacci numbers. But I was really a prankster as a kid. I loved magic, and I loved fooling my friends
stop,
and family.
Stop. The first what numbers?
Fibonacci.
One of those?
Those are, I don't even recall. It's been so long. Basically, just a mathematical calculation. I could look into Google, but I don't even recall what the Fibonacci numbers are. But anyway, what I did is instead of writing that program, I wrote a program that would actually grab the teacher's password. It was kind of like to pull a prank on him.
Oh.
So when he'd go to sign on to the computer, it would appear as he was signing onto the computer, but it was actually running a program. So he was signing onto my program, and the program would take his username and password, it would store it in a file, and then it would log him onto the computer.
Oh.
At first he couldn't believe, you know, how is Kevin getting all this? You know, how is he getting this? And it became like this cat and mouse, you know, pranksterism game between my teacher and myself. And eventually, you know, after I told him, he gave me an A for the program, actually gave me a lot of attaboys. He was actually impressed.
Yeah.
So actually, when I was in high school, the ethics of computer hacking at the time is you were patted on the back and you were encouraged to do this type of stuff, unlike today, where you can get into a lot of trouble.
So there really was once that atmosphere where
absolutely.
Where you were celebrated. You got into my computer. You did me in. By God, you get an A.
Oh, yeah. Like, if you came up with clever, innovative stuff, like back in the 70s, you're actually rewarded for this stuff.
Uh-huh.
And you're given a lot of attaboys. Unlike you do this today, you probably end up, you know, expelled from school. So in any event, in fact, most of the security professionals these days, or 95% of them were, you know, hackers in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, what had happened is, to make a long story short, is I was really interested in becoming the best at circumventing security vulnerabilities.
Hmm.
And I made some regrettable and stupid decisions, and I targeted the source code and source code is like the original programming instructions.
Of what?
Of certain operating systems, like Solaris and SunOS that was developed by Sun Microsystems, VMS that was developed by DEC, and I moved a copy of the source code to some computers over at USC in Los Angeles, so I could scour through the code to look for holes or vulnerabilities that have been patched and some that, you know, might have not been identified by the developers.
What do you think would happen to you in China if you did something like that?
You'd probably get the death penalty in China for anything these days.
Absolutely.
They would put a
bullet straight into your head. Stole the source code, that'd be it. You'd be dead.
Yeah, so that's what I did. So what I did is I stole the copy of the source code for different operating systems and cell phones for the purpose of identifying vulnerabilities, and then that's what led me into a lot of hot water. And then because of I had a case in 1988 where a federal prosecutor had told a judge that that I could start a nuclear war by simply whistling into the telephone. I think the guy was watching too many reruns of War Games.
Perhaps so.
And what ended up happening is then I was afraid that the government was going to really exaggerate my case, and I was going to be like held in solitary confinement for years. So then I ran, and I became a fugitive. And
How long were you a fugitive?
For about 3 years.
3 years.
And the time I was a fugitive, I adopted new identities, and I worked at a law firm as a system administrator.
Really?
And in fact, the name that I worked under at the law firm was Eric Weiss. Do you know who Eric Weiss is in real life?
I do not.
That's the real name of famous magician Harry Houdini.
Oh.
So I had a sense of humor, right? But I quickly learned that the FBI had no sense of humor. So what ended up happening, then I was moving around the country, and then I worked at a hospital in the IT department in Seattle.
Okay.
And I moved to Raleigh, North Carolina. And
what's it like being, I mean, knowing the FBI is after you, knowing that you blow your cover and you're going to prison, and for 3 years like that, what's that like?
Well, I treated it as I was running from the law. I had a, in my mindset, in my mind's eye, I treated it as if I was living an adventure, or as if I was just like an undercover covert type agent. You know, living a cover under a cover identity.
And how old were you at the time?
Mid-20s.
Man, what a life.
Fortunately, that portion of my life's over. And
okay, let's be clear, though. You never actually compromised the security of the United States government. You never went into CIA FBI or any
stole credit card
government
numbers,
agency.
It never wrote worms and viruses, never hacked into government computers. My crimes were, you know, stealing source code. Even though my purpose was to look for vulnerabilities, it still was theft nonetheless.
Did you have any goal?
My goal was to become the best at circumventing security. My best at knowing all the holes that other people did not know of.
Gotcha. And by having the source code, you would know all the holes.
Well, all the ones that I could possibly identify. Don't forget, you could have the blueprint right there, and some could be so obscure or difficult to identify that, you know, I might not see it. But it's kind of like the blueprint. It's like the secret recipe to the Orange Julius. And what's strange these days is a lot of the source code, except for like Microsoft Windows, which I wasn't interested in at the time, you know, it's pretty much one open source. So now anybody can get the source for free.
Well, there's so many holes in a lot of what Microsoft, of course, they've been, my God, I think I have actually more patches for my operating system than I do megabytes of operating system. Well, I'm serious. You ought to see the patch. You know, when you do a defrag, you can see it. You can see all the patches down there. My God, it's bigger than the operating system. So there must be a lot of holes in Microsoft stuff. Has that code ever been stolen, or I mean, has anybody otherwise?
Oh, yeah,
how do they
yeah.
know about all these codes or backdoors and you know, secret ways to get in?
Oh yeah, Microsoft. In fact, you know, several months ago, some of their source code was released onto the internet.
Really?
And in fact, parts of Windows 2000 and Windows XP.
Really?
Yeah, stolen from Microsoft. And what apparently had happened is Microsoft licenses portions of the source code to vendors that develop, you know, products that work for Windows.
Sure.
And the perpetrator broke into one of those companies and released the source code on the internet. In fact, somebody was, crazy enough to actually take that source code that was distributed over the internet and sell it on his website.
Holy.
And then the guy was, you know, obviously arrested, and I don't know whatever happened to him. but the source code of Microsoft's been out there. The reason that
this was the entire portions, you said, just portions of like XP and
like Internet Explorer.
And
Internet Explorer is like riddled with security vulnerabilities. That's why like a lot of people, I think even Gartner advised people to switch to Firefox, a different browser, because what happens if your browser, your Internet Explorer browser, is vulnerable, if you are persuaded or influenced to go to a particular website, or somebody sends you an email with a hyperlink and you click on it, and you go to a website that has certain code to exploit that vulnerability, the bad guy could take complete control over your computer by simply installing software common piece of software would be like a keystroke logger or a piece of spyware that monitors everything you do on your computer.
Let's stop it. Keystroke logger means that every key you hit, whether you're typing an email or doing anything else on your computer, is preserved and then transmitted to somebody else, yes?
Absolutely. It's like a wiretap. So every keystroke you do, if you're an AOL Instant Messenger, if you're sending an email, signing on to your online bank, every keystroke you type is simply captured in its email to email address, a dead drop, as they call it. And, it could be a free Yahoo or Hotmail account or a Gmail account.
All right. Would you differentiate for me, please? Somebody, Harold, sends an email that says, "Hey, Art, I've noticed just about everything on the web nowadays installs what's called a data miner to slow down our computers by running in the background, even logging offline. Some are even breaking my adware remover that is hardened against such attacks. I wonder, is there ever going to be a cure?" Now, is a data miner like a key?
What I think he's speaking to is software that is considered a type of spyware, but it basically monitors, what websites you're going to, so they could, send you marketing materials. I assume that's what he's talking about.
Is that what most of these data miners are, Kevin?
Well, what I look at as a data miner is basically going out and getting particular data and sticking it into a database. And what software he could be talking about is that's stealthily installed on your machine to send some intelligence back to some central point. The ones that I know about that exist are for advertising and marketing, and those do exist.
Well, I've had zillions of them, Kevin. I use the removal programs, and every time you use the removal programs, it finds tons of them. So
yeah, that's adware.
Yeah, adware or something like that, the bot stuff, whatever, different removal programs. But, man, there's a ton of it in there. So it's usually just, for advertising to figure out what you're interested in? Is it that,
Yeah, where you're going on the Internet, basically, looking at your cookies, or you've heard of double click, which is a lot of these e-commerce sites are affiliates. So basically, through cookies, they can kind of keep track to what sites that you visit on the Internet and report that data back so they could target you for marketing. It's just like if you go to Amazon and you start clicking on, computer books, and Amazon remembers by storing a cookie of what your interests were. So when you go back on to their site and do some shopping, it's going to...
no kidding. It puts up ads that are relevant to you?
Exactly.
How cool is that?
Exactly. And they're trying to make this cross-platform. So you imagine you're at Amazon.com and you eventually end up one day on, BarnesandNoble.com or whatever. But, maybe they can now do direct marketing towards you.
Wow.
All for marketing and advertising.
All right. Well, that's fairly mundane. I mean, that's not too bad. But you also have the feeling that these data miners or keystroke things or whatever could be a lot more malignant in their intent.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the adware, while people don't appreciate being tracked, for privacy purposes, the most insidious type of software is the real spyware, which monitors what you're doing. In fact, there was this guy in New York who went to all the different Kinko copier establishments out in New York and installed keystroke loggers on all those computers. So anyone that would use their online banking or sign on to sensitive email from Kinko's, all their communications were essentially, and all their keystrokes were monitored by the bad guy, and eventually got caught because what he was doing this was for identity theft.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So fortunately, he got caught. But you have to think about what all the what about all the other guys that are doing the same thing? Anytime you go up to an internet kiosk, anytime you use a you go to a Kinko's or anywhere where it's where you're not using a computer that you can trust, you could be easily monitored, and people don't even think about that.
Well, I want to ask a lot about that. I mean, I see advertisements on TV for shredders, so you can take your personal documents and shred them. Nobody can go through your garbage and steal your identity. The question is, how easy is it to steal your identity by hacking into somebody's computer? Is it easy or is it hard?
Well, usually that's not how it's done. Usually the bad guys are able to get certain non-public personal identifying information, like your mother's maiden name or your social security number, and people think these pieces of information are private, but anybody with an internet connection and a credit card could easily obtain these details and then become you.
Those are very important details. Kevin, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. When you call Social Security, talk about Social Security. They want to know your mother's maiden name and a couple other things, and then they know it's you.
Up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing, to have all these things in our memories hoard, and the wisdom to come.
Take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. My guest, Kevin Mitnick. Now, when you steal a company's source code and then you pass it around on the Internet, you are toying with the force. I mean, you really are toying with the force, messing with the force. In other words, these very large companies with millions of dollars invested in this software, and when you get it and look for vulnerabilities and go after it, you're definitely tampering with the force. And that force has a lot of money, and that force knows the FBI real well, and they go after you. And in Kevin's case, they caught him. The story is kind of what happened afterwards.
Everyone.
Well, once again, Kevin Mitnick. Kevin, do you think most corporations have an attitude that those hackers that don't kill you make you stronger?
The hackers that you don't kill will make you stronger?
The hackers that don't kill you will make you stronger. In other words, if you don't completely slaughter them by stealing their source code and finding all their vulnerabilities, then in the end, I mean, they, even though you go to prison and they want you tortured and killed, maybe, since you're not and you do get out of prison, then they want to employ you to help protect, right?
Yeah, that happens in some cases.
Not making them stronger.
Right, but not in all cases. Usually, well, they won't hire you directly. Usually they'll set up a Chinese wall, so they'll bring you up as a contractor, but usually they won't do it as an employee. But it usually comes to the same result.
Yeah. Yeah, in other words, you're showing, you are making them stronger, in effect. You're voluntarily or in their employ attacking their software, trying to find where others might get them.
Yeah, and today that's a big market. I mean, a lot of companies companies that are paying for vulnerability researchers.
Yeah, otherwise known as hackers that have come into the main world. Listen, ID theft, that is a big concern to me, and I know a fair amount about my computers. I've got, I don't know, too many of them, about 13 or 14 for my business and so forth. But so I know a fair amount, but I know enough to know how much I don't know. And so only somebody like you can tell me how much danger I'm really in.
Well, usually with respect to identity theft, if your computer is vulnerable and a bad guy breaks in, of course you might have certain data on there that might help them. But usually the people you have to be concerned about are looking for many pieces of information on many different people. So they're going to target databases. Like, for example, in the recent news, I don't know if you heard about this, Art, ChoicePoint, which is a company that sells non-public personal identifying information, was essentially hacked. LexisNexis apparently had some problems too. And this is where the bad guys get hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of social security numbers matched with names, with addresses, dates of birth, and so on. And this is where the serious problem exists. And because in America our system is broken to essentially become somebody else, all you need to know is certain key pieces of information. To get a birth certificate, to get a certified copy of a birth certificate, all the requester has to know is the person's full name, date of birth, place of birth, mother's name, father's name. Then the bad guy gets a copy of the birth certificate, and they could essentially become you. I mean, it's a real simple process, and that's because of how the system with identity works here in America.
No, you're absolutely right, and I've seen all the ads on TV. How widespread is it? How likely is anybody out there to get their ID stolen and then their money spent or whatever else?
Well, it's highly likely, but these people are, since they're targeting so many people, not just 1, 2, 3, 10,
right,
what they're doing is they're basically doing it based on information, you know, and if they have certain pieces of information about you, they can simply go online and apply for credit. Get an extension of credit in your name. There's even been cases where people open up a mortgage in your name, and all they need to know is certain key pieces of information about you. Like, for example, I can give you a website now.
No, don't. Listen.
Yes.
You're already scared the hell out of me. Every day I get no less than about 20 messages that say, you've been approved for a $60,000 mortgage.
Yeah.
Or something just like that.
Yeah, I get those all the time, too.
But that's not what you're talking about, is it?
No, not the spam. We're talking about, you know, information. And, I mean, And why I give this information out, like what I was going to give you, I won't give the site unless you want me to, but there are certain sites out there that have birth records, like for Kentucky, Texas, and California. And on every birth record is obviously the mother's maiden name. So anyone with the on the Internet for free can go look up anybody's mother's maiden name, like in California.
All right, if you say you get that, and obviously you can get that, with that, what can you do?
Well, I wonder how many of your listeners use their mother's maiden name to protect their bank account. Every time I call my credit card company or my financial institution, the first thing they ask me for is, what's your mother's maiden name?
Absolutely correct.
And why this needs to be out there in the public, why people need to know about these websites, is so they'll be encouraged to contact their financial institution immediately and change the mother's maiden name or set a password, because people are relying on protecting very sensitive information, like access to their bank account, based on information that's readily available on the internet.
God, that's frightening. Well, that's frightening. I'm
and of
sorry,
course, we all know about the caller ID spoofing, right?
Well, we all know about that. Yes.
Right.
Oh, jeez. So, but to actually get to somebody's money, it seems like it just wouldn't be that easy. It couldn't be that easy. Just your mother's maiden name. There'd have to be a
social security number, which also there's sites out there primarily for private investigators and underwriters that pretty much anybody can get an account at by filling out the appropriate paperwork, and then you can basically pull the person's social security number and date of birth, and you have the mother's maiden name. And it's quite simple for identity thieves to get extensions of credit in your name. Somebody stole my identity and opened up a cellular phone account in Denver and ran up, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of long-distance calls, and then I got the bill for it. It took me a little, you know, I had to prove it wasn't me, which was very time-consuming. But at the end of the day, I didn't have to pay the bill because it simply wasn't me.
God. But it cost you a lot of money to prove it wasn't you.
Well, time, and as we know, time equates to money. And what the biggest headache is, and I'm sure there's people in your audience that have also been victimized by this, is having your credit profile changed negatively. And then going back to these bureaus, I'm talking about TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian, and getting them to correct it. It's really time-consuming process, and the burden of proof shifts on you.
Yes.
And I really believe that when your identity is stolen, that to make it easier for the victim, that the burden of proof shouldn't shift to the victim, but should shift to the bureau.
Normally, however, in most cases I've heard of, the bank or with the institution does realize that it's a ripoff and restitution is made. And I always wondered, who actually pays for that? When that money...
The banks do. The issuers, the card issuers. But at the end of the day, we're all paying for it. Because
sure,
that's why they're
sure.
charging us higher interest rates, right? So, I mean, so everybody is paying for the thievery that's going on. But actually, the first, you know, the first line of the attack is going to be the issuer.
Okay.
In the instance of credit cards.
How severe is it? I wonder how much money they're having to pony up every year to pay off, you know, the frauds, the things.
Well, you know what's interesting? I was just at an event in New York. I spoke at an event and the heads of a lot of the major credit card companies were there.
Right.
And what they do is they base their they measure their losses. They call them basis points, and I don't know the exact calculation for it at this point because it really wasn't explained to me. But the bottom line is they basically measure their loss, and then they measure, well, how much money would it take us to offset the loss, or how much money is it going to take us to prevent this from happening? And so far, the attitude is one remedy is to use a stronger form of authentication. Authentication is when you have to prove that you are who you say you are.
Right.
Usually online, you do that through a password. But the problem is with all these phishing scams going on the internet,
uh-huh.
how do you, you know, and people are giving up their password through phishing scams by people that are victims of social engineering attacks. So these static passwords are really dangerous because you never know when somebody else has your password. So stronger forms of authentication are like smart cards, maybe a device you carry on your keychain that the code changes every 60 seconds, maybe a biometric like your thumbprint or you know an eye retina scan. Well, the problem is for banks, credit card companies and banks to deploy these technologies, it will actually cost them more money to deploy that technology than what the losses they were suffering. So what they do is they just choose to accept the loss.
But again, do you know what percentage they consider to be tolerable and what in fact they are paying? That's probably very secret.
Not really.
No?
I mean, I think one very large financial institution claimed that the fraud losses, I think, so far for the year were around $3 million.
Huh. Actually, that's not that much.
No. No, it isn't. And if it costs $10 million to deploy a stronger form of authentication that their customers could use,
then it's not going to be worth it.
It's not going to be worth it, so they just simply accept it, and that's it.
Huh. So as long as the identity thefts don't become too greedy, they're going to get away with it.
Well, they spread it out over several different victims. It's because not just like they're hitting MasterCard. They could be hitting,
Got it. But if it gets too pervasive and equals too expensive, then people will be lined up in shop.
Well, what's going to happen, then these companies will say, oh, to manage our risk, we'll deploy a stronger form of authentication to make it more difficult for the thieves to do their business.
Perhaps a chip in the palm of your hand.
Well, they're chipping credit cards these days. And in fact, in European countries, in some Eastern European countries, when you're defrauded, the risk is actually on the customer.
Really?
So, yeah, so think about it in America. Like, why would you want to bother yourself having to use all these fancy, devices to prove who you are when at the end of the day it doesn't cost you a dime if you're defrauded? It costs the bank. So, people really, don't care. But in Eastern European countries, it's the opposite. It's where the consumer takes the risk. So now they're interested in these, better forms of authentication, and they're really pushing for it because they don't want to take the loss.
Fascinating. All right. We should be on some sort of track here. I want to talk a little about social engineering. I know you do anyway. What do you mean by it? Explain your definition of social engineering.
Well, with social engineering, and the best definitions or the best information could be found in the old Art of Deception book. But real quickly, it's basically where the bad guy uses manipulation, deception, and influence tactics. I'm talking about the same influence tactics that sales and marketing people use.
Yes.
To persuade or to influence, rather, a trusted person inside a company to either reveal information or to do some sort of action item that lets the bad guy in, or gives the bad guy the information. It's simply the art of getting a person to say yes, to comply with a request, and this request is what benefits the bad guy.
Give me an example.
A guy walks into a building, a building of a company, and during the day when the receptionist is quite busy,
yes,
walks up to the receptionist maybe 10 minutes after sitting down. The person's dressed in a suit, so the person has that authority, looks like a typical business man or woman.
Probably a briefcase.
Immaculate hairstyle.
Yeah.
The trappings of a business person.
Yes.
Hands the receptionist a $5 bill and says, "Excuse me, miss, I found this money. It was on the floor over there, and I just wanted to turn it in." and the receptionist is very surprised and says, "Okay, well, thank you so much." And then about person sits down. 15 or 20 minutes later, the person goes back up to the same receptionist and says, "Listen, I just got an important SMS message or phone call. I need to get something off my computer. I need to be able to sit down somewhere. Is it possible I could just use the conference room behind you just for 10 or 15 minutes? If anybody comes in, I won't bother you. I'd really, really appreciate it because I need to get this taken care of."
Yes.
The receptionist knows that only employees are supposed to be in that conference room, but she thinks, well, she's attributed, a positive attribution of trust to this person based on the person turning in the $5 pill that they found on the floor. So she's thinking about it, and she goes, "Well, sure, I can trust this person." So he lets the guy into the conference room. The guy plugs in the laptop into an Ethernet jack in the conference room, because most companies have their network connectivity for conferences, of course. Finds it's a live jack behind the company's firewall. Person plants a wireless access point, about this wireless access point being a device that fits about the size in the palm of your hand, plugs in the wireless access point into this Ethernet jack, puts a note on the wireless access point, "Please do not remove, Information Security Department." And then from the parking lot with a directional antenna, of course. The bad guy has complete access to the company from the parking lot over radio.
This is a modern grift. This is grifting, Kevin.
Exactly. Well, social engineering is basically
grifting.
Using con artistry and using technical...
It's grifting.
Grifting is more... No, grifting, when you look at grifting art, it's more of You're grifting for cash. You're basically conning people out of money.
Well, hey, baby, what you just described ends up in the same place. It's a modern grift. That's
well,
what it is.
I think the definitions are different. This is, social engineering is where the bad guy or the hacker is getting access to company information or company resources by influencing people and using and exploiting technical vulnerability.
A rose by any other name. It's still a grift. All right, so anyway, I get the picture. I get how it's done, and that's pretty awful.
I mean, you know, a quick other story is imagine you're at a Premier Radio Networks in Sherman Oaks, and that's quite a building,
yeah.
If you've ever been there. And imagine that you're on the elevator.
I've never been there.
Oh, okay.
Is that amazing or what?
Yeah. Not really. You're outside the state, so... I was there a few times. So anyway,
I'm sure they're happy to hear that.
But I did do what I'm going to tell you.
I bet they're all checking their Ethernet ports right now for little notes.
Little notes, property of Premier Security, right? So listen to this. Imagine you're in the elevator in the restroom and you find a CD, you know, like in a red jewel case. And it has the logo of Premier Radio Networks on there. And you look at it. You found it on the elevator. Someone must have dropped it. And it says, extremely proprietary and confidential payroll salary history, second quarter 2005.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
What are the chances that somebody, you know, that was in the elevator or whomever is going to take that back to their computer and just do a quick check? What do their bosses make? What do their colleagues make? They put in the CD. It comes up with like an Excel document. They click on it, and nothing happens. It says it's corrupted or whatever.
They either toss
the CD or they give it to human resources.
Yeah, they say what a bunch of bulls. Stupid joke.
Happens is what do they do after clicking that document and installed a piece of malicious software on their computer that can essentially do anything the bad guy wants? That's because under Windows, usually everyone runs with administrator rights.
Good God, this is diabolical.
Right. So then. You have a keystroke logger that's sitting there, you know, basically installed a wiretap on the victim's computer that clicked on that spreadsheet, or worse yet, it's a program that attempts to connect out from that person's computer to the internet to another machine, another computer that the bad guy had compromised, so now they could use that as a tunnel into Premier Radio Network's network.
What idiot let you into our building?
I would call him it. No, he's not an idiot. But David Hall let me into your building.
David Hall. I stand by my statement.
No, but he's a good guy.
No, David's all right.
He's cool.
God, I know they're doing some thinking down there right now.
So there's an example of a social engineering attack, which is a little bit different. It's actually influencing the target by getting access to something that they'd really like to look at. And by doing so, getting them to install malicious software on their computer that gives the bad guy an advantage.
Yeah, David Hall, by the way, is just the kind of guy that probably would have hired you back in your heyday. Hold on, Kevin. We'll be right back to you. Kevin Mitnick is my guest. Check those Ethernet ports, folks, down at our building. I have this awful, shivery feeling running right up my spine. He is our guest. Nevertheless, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM in the nighttime.